This is the Santita Jackson Show.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Santita Jackson Show. WCPT 820, the nation's largest progressive talk radio station based here in Chicago, AM 950 Radio. My home up in Minneapolis, St. Paul. Love you, Gary Hines, from Sounds of Blackness this morning. Love you, Chad, and all my people up there on AM 950 Radio, Minneapolis, St. Paul. You know, we're going to have a high of 41 degrees. It's going to be kind of warm here in Chicago today, but it will be cloudy. Minneapolis, St. Paul, snow showers, a high of 38 degrees. The Dow closed up 60 points yesterday. The NASDAQ closed up 36 points. The S&P was up a point and a half. Today, we're going to be talking about the impeachment at 8 o'clock Central Standard Time, 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Something unprecedented in the history of the Republic is going to happen. President Donald Trump will be the first president in history to have a second impeachment. And more of the Republican establishment are jumping aboard. So we're going to be talking about that. More and more people are saying, are questioning the military and police role in the events that happened a week ago today at the U.S. Capitol. So we're going to be talking about that. And something unprecedented is happening as well. Governor Snyder, former Governor Snyder of Michigan, has been indicted for the Flint water crisis for his role in it. We're going to be talking with the former mayor of Flint, Michigan, Karen Weaver. Dr. Karen Weaver became the mayor just as this crisis was blossoming, and many people credit her with helping to usher in a renaissance in Flint, Michigan. And of course, she'll be joining Dr. Deborah Verhoeven. We've got Pastor Stephen Thurston, one of my favorite people in the world, my baby brother. He is, of course, the teaching pastor at Salem Baptist Church, the House of Hope. Cannot wait to get some good news from him. But right now, we're going to go right into these headlines. Paul Jarvi, so let's hit it. Everybody, GOP support for impeachment is growing as Republicans say that they will vote against President Trump. According to this HuffPost report, a growing chorus of congressional Republicans announced their support for the impeachment of Donald Trump on Tuesday, led by Republican leader Liz Cheney of Wyoming. That's right. The GOP dam broke on Tuesday when Representative John Katko of New York said he'd vote to impeach the president. Then Representative Liz Cheney, the number three Republican in the House, issued a stark statement that she, too, would vote to impeach the president. Wow. The walls are closing in on him. And according to the House articles of impeachment, the president is a clear and present danger to the Republic. Wow. The House intends to impeach him today for inciting a violent insurrection that just 1 week ago today stormed the U.S. Capitol. And we're finding out more and more about just how ugly that scene was and how these lawmakers and everyone there felt, and actually their lives were in peril. Indeed, we have got three of the members of Congress have tested positive for COVID-19 after being sheltered in a room during this insurrection. Representative Bonnie Watson of New Jersey, Pramila Jayapal of Washington. I misspoke yesterday and said that she was from California. She is from Washington State. And Brad Schneider from here in Illinois. We keep them in our prayers. But Ayanna Pressley saw that some people were in that room and they were going to be unmasked. And, of course, that congresswoman from Massachusetts, she left the room. She said, I refuse to be in here. In the meantime, we're watching President Trump's approval ratings crater in the final days. A new political morning consult poll pegs his approval rating at just 34%, the lowest in 4 years of tracking opinions of the president's job performance. More than 6 in 10 voters, 63%, disapprove of him. Mitch McConnell is said to believe the impeachment of President Trump would make it easier to purge him from the GOP. What do you think, everybody? I want you to call me or text me at 773-763-WCPT, 773-763-9278. GWC Injury Lawyers makes it possible for you to text. So I'm going to work on getting some of these texts. I know Paul is really, really swamped in that studio, but we're going to work on getting your text on the radio. We want to hear from you. We want you to join me on Facebook on the Santita Jackson and Friends page and join the Morning Stars so that you can talk with them and so that we can continue to engage in this conversation. As the impeachment rolls forward, Vice President Pence is refusing to invoke the 25th Amendment as Democrats and Republicans now are working to remove President Trump from office. There's an FBI report warning of, quote, war, close quote, at the Capitol, contradicting claims that there was no indication last week of looming violence. A report of war at the Capitol. Wow. And now President Trump supporters are planning armed protests ahead of the Biden inauguration, according to the FBI. The FBI has warned of possible armed protests across the U.S. as President Trump supporters and far-right groups call for demonstrations just before President-elect Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris are sworn in as president and vice president. We will be on the lookout. Absolutely chilling. That is a headline from Common Dreams. House Democrats on Monday were briefed by the U.S. Capitol Police on several disturbing potential armed demonstrations and assassination plots planned in the coming days by supporters of President Donald Trump, an indication that the deadly invasion of the halls of Congress last week may have been just the start, according to this report, of a broader wave of right-wing violence ahead of President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration. Wow, everybody, that's something that we need to watch out for. Indeed, they captured, as they look at all of these videos, a Proud Boy by the known by the name of Spazzo. He was someone who helped to lead the insurrection at the Capitol. But so many people were involved in this, so many people, and a lot of people are asking a lot of questions. I continue. After her positive COVID-19 test, Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal has demanded that the House Sergeant-at-Arms remove GOP lawmakers who refuse to wear masks. Late Monday, she castigated Republican lawmakers for their life-threatening refusal to wear face coverings and demanded that they be held to account after the Washington Democrat tested positive for COVID-19 along with two of her other colleagues. And that's just what we've heard of thus far. In a furious statement, Jayapal slammed Republican lawmakers for cruelly and selfishly, as she put it, refusing to, quote, take the bare minimum of COVID-19 precaution. What do you think about that? Should they be fined? I mean, like something docked from their paychecks. This is unbelievable. At least three lawmakers who were in that room, at least three, have been diagnosed as COVID-19, and we pray that their health will be restored. In the meantime, in the wake of the insurrection last week, the House has installed metal detectors to check congressional lawmakers after these riots. They will now be required to walk through metal detectors just like everybody else before entering the House of Representatives chamber in the wake of the Capitol riots. Now, this is where they go and vote, everybody. Effective immediately, the acting sergeant at arms announced on yesterday. All persons, including members, are required to undergo security screening before entering the chamber. They're being checked for guns, everybody. Can you believe that? House of Representatives, they're checking the members now. You can't make this stuff up. And something else unprecedented. We're just living in an unprecedented times, everybody. Top military leaders, the leaders of the Pentagon, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, U.S. Army, General Mark Milley, in an extraordinary letter, the nation's top commanders, led by him, they did not mention President Trump by name, but they made it clear that the military intends to stand by the constitutional transfer of power to the next administration. Quote, they wrote, as we have done throughout our history, the U.S. military will obey lawful orders from civilian leadership, support civilian authorities to protect lives and property, ensure public safety in accordance with the law, and remain fully committed to protecting and defending the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Why do you think they felt compelled to put out that message? Many people are questioning how many military members were involved in the insurrection. Gotta ask these questions. Gotta ask these questions. In the meantime, ex-Michigan Governor Rick Snyder is facing criminal charges. He and several former officials have been indicted in connection with the 2014 Flint water crisis that led to at least 12 deaths and dozens of illnesses. The numbers are far greater, everybody. Cannot wait to talk with Dr. Deborah Furholden and former Flint Mayor Karen Weaver, Dr. Karen Weaver, about that. Sadly, the U.S. COVID-19 death toll continues to rise. More than 4,400 people died yesterday, according to Johns Hopkins. Nearly 4,500 people in 24 hours. And now, even in Los Angeles, check this out, everybody. Health officials are advising some residents to wear masks at home as the COVID-19 outbreak spreads. And now the United States is going to require all arriving passengers coming internationally to have a COVID-19 test. And the Chicago School Board is locking out some teachers from virtual classrooms, and they're threatening to dock their pay if they don't report to in-class teaching and learning. We have one of my dearest friends, indeed one of the great prophetic voices of our time, Reverend Stephen Thurston II. He's the teaching pastor at the Salem Baptist Church, the House of Hope. He has a fantastic book, Mirror Moments. I'm going to have him back on so that we can talk about it further. But he's been to the top schools in the world, Oxford, Morehouse. I should start with Morehouse, Northwestern, everywhere. He's been the head of the youth initiative at PUSH, been very, very involved with the NAACP, the Urban League, with everybody. And but he is first a man of the word, a man of God. And so he is bringing us some good news today. And he's got 5 minutes, so go and help us make sense of these unprecedented times. It's absolutely crazy. Welcome back to the show, Pastor Thurston.
Thank you, Santita. Always a pleasure to share with you and your amazing audience. Well, Santita, I know you're a music lover, and I'm a music lover too, a student of music. And the medium of music has served as such an important storytelling tool for millennia. From the stark description of racism in Billie Holiday's Strange Fruit to the idealism of John Lennon's Imagine, to Public Enemy's call to action, Fight the Power, even to the cultural inquisitions of Marvin Gaye's What's Going On. Songs possess the power to define the present as well as to shape the future. A good song, as you know, has the ability to transport individuals into a world, into a space better than any exposition or dialogue ever could. And when we consider the sociological implications of music, it's striking how grossly unaware we are of the aphonic influence songs have upon the human psyche, as the lyrics subconsciously move us, shape us, and even change us. And again, as a music lover and as a theologian, as a pastor, as a preacher, I'm often drawn to the Psalms, which are actually songs. Psalms 126 captured my attention recently in my time of meditation and study. And it goes on to say there in the verses that God has done great things for us. This text was speaking about the children of Israel. After 70 years of bondage in Babylon, they had been released. It had been declared by the king that they could be free, that they could go back home. And they began singing what great things God had done for them. King Cyrus gave a decree, and now God gives them some deliverance. And these emancipated people reverently respond now to what God had done in their life by singing great things. And when I examine this song that they sang, I believe it's a song that all of us, regardless of our religious tradition, should be singing right now. And people may say, why, Stephen, this is crazy. I can understand why these people, after 70 years of bondage, are singing great things. But great things aren't happening in my life. My finances are messed up. My health isn't in order. Things aren't so great in my city, in my country, in my community. So, Stephen, why should I be singing great things? Well, when I look back at this song in Psalms 126, I saw that this song was a word of praise. Here, the children of Israel, they've been delivered from captivity, but they were returning to a homeland that they found decimated and destroyed. Their blessing is now met with some burdens. They were living in between in life, in between the already and the not yet. They've been delivered, they've been set free, but everything that they were returning to have been decimated and destroyed. The neighbors are nasty towards them. There was no food for them to eat. The vineyards have been destroyed. All of this is taking place. But yet at the same time, they were singing a word of praise because they recognized that God's past provisions had set the precedent and a pattern that ought to give them some peace about the future and position them to still praise God regardless of their present predicament. And I believe that that's happened in all of our lives, because the reality of the matter is that we've all been through 100% of everything that was supposed to take us out. We've survived. We've pressed through. It may have been difficult. It may have been hard. But we can still praise and celebrate because we're still here. Not only was it a word of praise, but it was also a word of prayer. When the decree is declared, granting their deliverance, it was only a portion of the population that returned, while a great number remained in that place of exile. And many of them, in a phased way, were able to be delivered and come on back home. But the word of prayer that these individuals that were released gave was for their brothers and their sisters, their neighbors and their friends, at some point to recognize, hey, we've been freed, we've been delivered. They had care and concern for others because this was a collective community in this cultural context. And we ought to be singing words of prayer for our brothers and sisters, for our neighbors and friends that are struggling, that haven't made it out, that have lost loved ones, as you mentioned yesterday, being one of the largest states in terms of the death toll with this COVID situation. There ought to be continuous words of prayer that are lifted for others who have not been as fortunate as some of us have been in the midst of our pandemic. Finally, it was a word of promise. As they close out this particular psalm and as you read this particular text, you recognize that the text talks about seed time and harvest. There's a sower who's sowing in tears. He's sowing in tears because he's putting down into the ground that which he actually needed for himself in the moment. It was a tough time. They returned home, and things were not the way that they left them. There was no food. The vineyards had been destroyed. The neighbors were nasty to them. All of this thing is happening, but this sower has some seed, and though he could have taken that seed and made meal for his family, he sows it because that seed was the only thing separating he and his family from future starvation. He makes a sacrifice and sows that seed into the ground. And when the time comes, there's a harvest that allows them to move forward in life and to have enough sustenance to sustain themselves. And the promise that's made here is that no matter where you are, God will provide. Our favorite pastor, Pastor Clay Evans here in Chicago, would often tell us, there is no secret what God can do. What he's done for others, he'll do the same thing for you. And I pray for all of the listeners today that whatever you've sown in tears over the course of 2020, you'll reap in a harvest in the year 2021. Because God has, God is, and God shall continue to do great things in our lives, through our lives, and for our lives.
Amen. The teaching pastor of Salem Baptist Church, the son of one of my favorite pastors, who I love, Reverend Stephen Thurston the First. How about that? The grandson of Big Baby. Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King used to call your grandfather one of the great preachers. Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King used to call his, my mother reminded you. Yeah, because he looked like Pastor Thurston does. They don't age, everybody. I'm like, is this Dorian Gray? Just kidding. But, you know, I'm sending you much love, but I thank you for that word today. Then I want you to come back so that we can talk about mirror moments, because, you know, I think that we are in a mirror moment. We're going to have to look at ourselves. We're being forced to do that.
For sure.
Because we're just very quickly, in about a minute, give me a word about that.
Listen, I believe we talked about 2020 being the year of vision. So many people said that perfect vision. And I really think it was. It exposed so much globally, nationally, locally, but personally, people got to really see the real what they're really made of. And it's important that if we want to see change, we recognize that change doesn't come from the outside, but rather from in the inside. And it's when we change what's within that we're able to change what's around. When we own our stuff, because all of us got some stuff, we got to own it. We got to face it in order for us to fix it. And one of the great problems of America is that we keep misdiagnosing what the problem is. And whenever you misdiagnose things, you never get to a true solution. And one of the diagnoses that we need to make is that all of us are messed up in some way, shape, form, or fashion. And we need help. We got to change it.
Amen. You know, if you got cancer, you don't need cold medicine. You need chemo, everybody. We need chemo right now. We got a lot to do.
That's it.
Reverend Stephen Thurston, I can always count on you for saying something profound. Mirror Moments is the book that you need to get. Go to Stephen. What is your website, Stephen?
Stephen with the PH, jthurston.com.
Okay, very good.
StephenJThurston.com.
He's going to come back and talk to us about his book, because I think we do need to face up to ourselves. Sending you much love. Give my love to your parents and to the rest of your family, who are my family. We've got Dr. Deborah Verholden. Absolutely sending you much, much, much love. Thank you for being with us today. Some great news before we have former mayor of Flint, Karen Weaver, join you. Something happened in Flint, Michigan, and I reached out to you immediately. I couldn't believe it. Thank you, Michael Moore, for having it on your chat line. What happened?
Well, it's been a long time coming. And I will tell you, there's a lot happening in Flint, especially as it relates to this water crisis settlement, because the numbers that are being put on the table, and I'm writing about this in another format, they don't make sense. You know, we have a city of 100,000 people that were impacted, residents. And then there's all the people who aren't residents but are stakeholders. So the people who may not live in Flint proper, but work there, play there, worship there, go to school there, their kids go to daycare there. So there's an estimated another 100,000 or so people who were also affected, right?
Sure.
And, you know, the settlement's on the table right now is just over $640 million for, you know, 100,000 people in the city, another 100,000 people who were exposed. That doesn't include all of the businesses. You know, it's just, no, it's just layer on top of layer on top of layer on top of layer. And so there's a lot happening all at the same time. And I think the former governor,
just very quickly, because I got about 30 seconds before I go to break. What, he's been indicted?
They say he's going to be charged. I haven't seen evidence that he has been charged. Yesterday, the talk was that he was going to be arrested and he would be charged. I haven't seen no evidence that he's been arrested. That doesn't mean he hasn't been. I just haven't seen that evidence, and I wouldn't speak on something that I couldn't verify myself. But it looks like it's coming. And I will tell you, dancing in the streets, because people want justice. People want justice. It's not about seeing harm to him. It's about justice. He knew
absolutely
what was happening. He covered it up. He set the whole thing in motion. Then he covered it up. And then he walked away as if he was, you know, had no say in anything. And people
that's the final word.
It's not fair.
Yes. Absolutely. We'll be back to talk about it with you and the former mayor of Flint on the Santita Jackson Show. Back in a few minutes.
This is the Santita Jackson Show.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Santita Jackson Show. See, if you join the Morning Stars, Chaperl and Lady Di, DFC Fleming, and Vicky, and Joyce Ann, and Michael Ann, and Paula, and Philip, and all the people, all the folks, you would be hearing our conversation offline. Boy, we have a great time. Well, actually online on Facebook Live on the Santita Jackson and Friends page. And you can also go to WCPT 820. We're streaming live there as well. And if you want to listen to us, if you can only listen and not watch, go to WCPT820.com and AM950radio.com. I want you to call or text me. 773-763 WCPT 773-763-9278. GWC Injury Lawyers, thank them for giving you the opportunity to text. We're talking about Flint, Michigan. What happened there? In 2014, we just know that the people of Flint had poisoned water, poisoned by lead. And what does lead do? Well, it does awful things. And so Dr. Deborah Verholden can talk to us about that. And, of course, we've been talking about that. You heard her getting amped up. She said, we just need justice, because it looks like the governor, the sitting governor who oversaw that crisis, who knew so much, he might be indicted, along with other officials who worked with him. Wow. And then we've got the former mayor of Flint, who inherited that crisis and who really is credited with leading the Renaissance, helping to lead Flint up out of that. Former mayor Dr. Karen Weaver, who's also a practicing psychologist. And, of course, we've got the president of the National Bar Association, who was just doing cartwheels and she was flipping over the moon about her sister, beloved, Dr. Karen Weaver, Mayor Karen Weaver. Why were you so excited? The normally uptight and upright CK attorney, girl, you know I'm having fun with you. I had to put it out there. Yeah.
I'm normally uptight. Well, first of all, good morning, Santita. Much love to you as always. Dr. Jennifer Holden, the foremost epidemiologist in the world. Good morning. If I'm typically uptight and upright, today calls for me to not be uptight and upright. I don't know I was uptight and upright, but if I am, today calls for me not to be.
In the courtroom, uptight. And I love it. In the courtroom, right. I feel very secure with you now.
But I have to say, I was flipping cartwheels because in my 34 year history of being a practicing lawyer and having been a lobbyist, having worked all around the world, really, with government officials, having had the pleasure of representing also, you know, Reverend Jackson, Rainbow Push, all and civil rights organizations. There's one client that stands out to me as a freedom fighter who represented people in need at a time in history when people needed her every day, every single day. Day in and day out, in an exemplary way, with class, beauty, brilliance, intelligence, and who assembled an amazing team. And that was Dr. Mayor Karen Weaver. And so when I just heard her voice, I said, wait a minute. I broke from a moment, you know, my usual lawyer-like demeanor, because I was just too excited, because I saw up close and personal, not just from a distance. First of all, Flint, I've got family in Flint, but that's not what I base it on. I base it on the fact that I've had the pleasure of representing the city of Flint in opioid litigation. And my client is Mayor Karen Weaver. And so I had the pleasure of interfacing with her extensively, her team, and seeing her work. Absolutely amazing. You want to talk about a model person who has served her people? It is Dr. I don't know if I say Dr. or Mayor first, Karen Weaver.
I don't either.
I know that is not the last chapter of her public service. Oh my goodness, I am so honored to be in the presence of a magnificent leader.
Let me just say this, and I feel exactly the same way. I didn't know you were on here. You know, Santina keeps secrets sometimes. I did not know you were there.
Yes.
So I think that's some of it, too. And we did not really get to talk. I was able to give her a shout-out not that long ago. You remember that? When we were...
Yes, and you know, we were shouting out each other.
That's right. Exactly. But we haven't been able to see each other. And it was so wonderful because I really felt like you were added to our team and helped us do some really good things in Flint that are not over. They are not over. And so,
well,
you know, I'm looking. Yes.
And that's why I was very excited about, you know, at the last minute, because, you know, I spoke with everyone very late for me about bringing the three of you together, because, you know, you stepped outside of your role as a practicing psychologist and you said, my city needs saving. I've got to do something. C.K. Hoffler could be making, I mean, she could be extremely wealthy if she would not take out the time to defend those people who need defending, because people from all over the world seek out her legal advice and help. And Dr. Deborah Furholden got her Ph.D. from Johns Hopkins at 24. Johns Hopkins is probably the preeminent school for epidemiology in the world. And she moved from Johns Hopkins while she's on being fast-tracked to do big things there. And she comes to Flint. You got everybody to go to Flint. Rachel Maddow, everybody went to Flint because no one could believe what happened there. And then I couldn't believe that it's possible that the governor who oversaw this could face indictment. So I need you to explain, because I need you to explain, Mayor Weaver, what we're looking at with the governor. I need I need our legal eagle, the people's attorney, to explain to us what we're looking at legally. And I need Dr. Deborah Verholten to talk to us about what's happening with people there in terms of their health, because she saw someone, because people are boiling this water, and she said, look, I go to hotels in other cities so I can bathe properly. I mean, this is unbelievable. So what happened with former Governor Snyder, Mayor Weaver, Dr. Weaver,
Starting? Let me ask you that question. Where would you like me to start?
What did he know and when did he know it?
You know what? When I got into office, I have to believe that he already knew it, because we had been screaming out for 18 months. You know, for 18 months, we knew brown water was bad. A child knows brown water is bad. And so this had been going on. And one of the things I also said is this man poisoned the community and covered it up. And so he didn't do it by himself. He had to have help with a cover up when you poison a city. And that was going on then. And we knew that he knew, because in the state building, they weren't using the water. They were having bottled water shipped into them. So they knew then what was going on. And the problem was they wanted to just quietly address this issue. You know, they thought that everybody will say the water's fine and we're going to fix it. That was their plan, but their plan backfired because they really didn't anticipate me getting in office. They really never anticipated an emergency being called in the city of Flint. So Snyder and his people knew what was going on for a very long time, because they knew they didn't put corrosion control in the water and never fixed it, you know?
Well, how did this happen in the first place? How did the water get the lead in it? What happened?
You know, because they put profit over the public health and well-being of the people. That's what happened. When you look at the emergency manager law that's in Michigan, that's what happened. And all of these black and brown communities were taken over by emergency manager, which really turned out to be a dictatorship. When you look at what they did to Flint, with Pontiac, Detroit, Benton Harbor, and the list goes on. And so our voice was taken, and supposedly, let's say that, the power was taken from elected officials, because the emergency manager came in and made all decisions. And I remember one of the things I said is, I may not have power, but my voice is my power. And one thing, that's something no one can take from you. But they came in and they were trying to find ways to save money. And that's fine to find ways to save money, but how do you switch a water source and not test it before you give it to people? You know, how do you do that? You know, how do you do that? How do you say, we're going to switch your water? No, we're not going to test it, but we're going to switch it. And then when the people started crying out, nothing is done. We were told, just run your water a little bit longer. Run it for 2 to 3 minutes before you start to use it. Excuse me?
What?
That did nothing. Yeah, that's what we were told to do. The water was fine because the regulatory agencies were saying that. MDEQ at that time was saying that the water was fine and met MDEQ standards. And the EPA was saying absolutely nothing. And so it was a cover up on so many levels. That was what happened. And that, you know, that was how it started. That was how it started. But a lot of people don't know it was we were really crying out about our water. Our water issue started as the cost, because our cost had been raised illegally through this emergency manager, you know, the system. And that's what our fight was about. And then we started noticing there's E. coli in the water. There's bacteria in the water. And then that switch was made, and that's when lead got in the water, because when they didn't put corrosion control in, our pipes were stripped because of that water not having corrosion control. And the protective coating that had built up on those pipes was taken away, and so lead started leaching into the water.
Before I get to you, CK, Dr. Deborah Verholten, what does lead in the water do to people? I mean, to children, to adults. What does lead in the water do to you?
Well, so we already know that lead is a very potent neurotoxin. And it's unfortunate, and Flint is not unique in this aspect, but a lot of cities by mandate, the pipes are made of lead. Back when many cities' water infrastructures were being built, the alternative was wood, right? And can you imagine your water infrastructure being built from wood? So by mandate, a lot of cities' water infrastructures were made with lead pipe. Lead was the best that we had at the time. We didn't quite understand the impacts that it had on human development and the body and all of these other things. And so what happened is, as Mayor Weaver explained, the stripping of it's a nice little biosphere, little ecosystem that exists in water pipes. And as long as it stays stable, it's good. But then when you disrupt that and you run very acidic water that violates all of the engineering standards and codes for how water gets treated and handled, and the lack of anti-corrosion was just one important piece of a whole lot of breaches and honoring protocols around how water is treated, then that lead gets into the water. And the problem with lead in water, we've heard about lead paint cases, right? I was in Baltimore City for 20 years, and we know that lead is a potent neurotoxin. It has a very negative impact on human development, fetal development. It causes brain damage and other cognitive deficits in children, adolescents. And when it's in the water, you can't get away from it, because people drink it, they use it to cook with, to brush their teeth, to shower, to bathe. And so it becomes an inescapable, but known and prior avoidable harm to people. So having something that's bad for your community in the water is the worst place to have it, probably besides having it be in the air, because you can't get away from it. And then think about what happened with COVID. COVID happened, and the primary recommendation for people was to wash your hands. But you've got people who don't trust what's coming out of their tap who are now being told, use this now more than ever, because hand hygiene is going to be critical to keeping yourself safe. It has a profound, profound impact on development, which is why we've seen such an emphasis of the impact of lead on children. And the last thing I want to say is, lead was a big problem, but it was not our only problem. Disrupting that water ecosystem caused a lot of imbalances, and we saw spikes in things like E. coli and Legionella and Legionnaire's disease. We had an excess number of deaths that exceeded anything that we had had in the decade before for other waterborne illnesses as well. So lead was a big one, but by no means was it the only one.
CK, what happened with this settlement? Because it seems to me, it sounded like a big settlement, what, $600 million plus dollars? But it seemed to me, with all the people who got this, it didn't sound like it was a lot of money. Did it help anybody?
Well first of all, Santita, again, I want to say thank you, and thank you for having me on the show with this extraordinary panel. Dr. Mayor Karen Weaver and Dr. Deborah Verholden, extraordinary women, and you. I just have to say, whenever you have a settlement, first of all, $600 million settlement appears to be a lot of money, but it depends on how the monies are going to be dispersed. Typically, in a situation like this, you have monies that are used for different things. It might be programmatic initiatives, and there might be monies that are going to individuals. But by the time attorney's fees and all that, by the time it trickles down to the individuals that need it, if they get it, and it's usually based on a grid, the money becomes a very, very small amount. So if it goes to individuals, but in this case, that money, the question is, what was that money used for? That is a good question. I think that is part of an investigation. I'm not suggesting that it was used illegally. I just think that one has to delve into how have those funds been used. But the bigger question, the overriding question, is why was this allowed to happen? And I think that's what we have to get to. Because I would submit, and I am completely in support, holding those accountable who made the decision to shift the water, to switch the water, the city of Flint's water, to the Flint River, and all of the things that followed from them, and the governor, the then governor, Rick Snyder, his health director, and others who were working for them. This was not an accidental decision. This is not something that happened on accident. This is something that happened by deliberate steps, deliberate actions, deliberate executive orders and the like to do this. And it devastated a black city. So now I'm getting to why I believe from a legal standpoint, those responsible should be prosecuted to the fullest. I believe that this happened in part because sometimes people don't see us and they simply don't care. They don't care that hundreds of thousands of, because it's not just those people living in Flint, it's all those connected to those people living in Flint who were impacted by this, simply didn't care. This did not happen in one of the wealthiest cities in the state of Michigan. This happened, or a predominantly white city in the state of Michigan. This happened in Flint, Michigan, a city that I don't want to say was directly targeted, but when you don't care, you make decisions because you don't care about the impact of those affected in that community. So it is about time for those who directed that to be held accountable to the families of Flint, Michigan. And yes, I'm going to say it, they need to be held accountable also to Dr. Mayor Karen Weaver, because Mayor Weaver was the first and the most dynamic elected official who took the bull by the horn and said no more for the citizens of Flint. And they need to help be held accountable to her. I know, Mayor Weaver, you're back in private practice, but they need to look at you in the eye because you fought for the people of Flint. They need to look at all of those families in the eye, those children that were impacted, those loved ones, those senior citizens. And I can tell you, and I'm not a doctor, but I know how these types of cases roll. The numbers of people that are impacted and that may have died that were unreported or underreported, that's going to be another thing that needs to be investigated on some level, because it may be sometimes when people pass away, sometimes you don't have in the autopsy report the real cause. So right. I just think that to the maximum extent possible, there should be prosecution for those that made that decision. And I think that it's about time to hold people accountable. How, what is it going to take for this notion that black people are expendable and don't mean anything, don't count, and their lives don't matter? When is that going to stop? The only way that it's going to stop is if you hit people in their pocket, if you hit people through the criminal justice system and bring them up on charges, and that prosecutors, in this case, have the courage, because it takes courage, have the courage to see it through to the end. And in this case, given the how it is decimated, destroyed the community in Flint, I think it needs to be, this needs to be prosecuted to the fullest. And I'm going to go a step further. As president of the National Bar Association, if there are lawyers that need to be corralled to assist with this, and it would be highly unlikely that they would call on us, but we're going to make the offer. We're going to make the offer to have lawyers who are available to assist in the investigation and the prosecution. They can, there can be outside lawyers involved in this because we represent the people in our community. And Flint has been impacted. I, you know, Mayor Weaver, you don't even know this. The first time I went down to meet with you all to talk about our case, you handed me a bottle of water. You all handed me a bottle of water. That cut us and my co-counsel, Navan Ward, to our heart, because we thought, we were thinking of, oh my goodness.
What did it look like?
You can't, when you go, well, no, a bottle of water, just water to drink.
Oh my goodness.
We couldn't even, we for us to just even function, we need water. We had to have a bottle of water as visitors into the city. And it's not until that happens to you that your mind starts thinking of all of those families, those African-American families in the city of Flint.
Well, hold on. Because
every single day of their lives, drink a bottle of water, if they haven't.
Well, stay right there, because Deborah Verholden, you were visiting a friend, and you saw this young boy do what? I got about 3 minutes left here. You saw him filling up.
I was being recruited for a new public health bill that, thank God, predated the Flint water crisis. It was a partnership between the community, between a large local foundation, the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation. The residents of Flint were really driving that. Leaders at Michigan State University were recruiting me to come back. I lived in Flint as a teenager. My mom lived in Flint. My dad, stepdad, retired from the truck and bus on Vance Light. You know, everybody, a lot of people in the city work for General Motors or one of its affiliates. And so I said, well, I'll come and take a look, but there's no way I'm leaving my great job at Johns Hopkins and all the work I'm doing in Baltimore. I was at the forefront. I'm a drug epidemiologist by training, and I mostly worked on drugs and violence. I was doing that work happily in Baltimore and fighting a good fight there. And when I came to Flint, I couldn't believe what was happening. I couldn't believe the city. I got a world-class education in Flint. I went to Flint Northern High School. That school now is falling down. It has greenery growing out through the windows. You can't believe, but it's a product of all of the substantial economic divestment that happened in the city. So as I came back and just started visiting with people and looking around, I go to my friend's house. He was my high school sweetheart. His grandmama lived on the south side, and when she passed, he lived in Mount Morris, which is a kind of slightly wealthier, little bit wealthier township right outside of Flint. He moved into his grandma's house on the south side. I watched him make a bottle for his grandson, and I could see that the water was discolored because I could see it in the bottle. It wasn't visibly noticeable coming out of the tap. And I watched him boil that water and then put it back in the bottle and make a formula bottle for his grandson.
Oh my gosh. My friend
had to be on suicide watch when people were lied to so bad. I want to make something really, really clear. The switch itself was not the egregious crime, okay? Because, you know, making these tough economic decisions to use your local municipal water, et cetera, cities are faced with those decisions all the time. The real egregious crime was when they violated all of the standards for how you first test water, how you treat water, and then how you ongoingly monitor to make sure that you are doing no harm to the residents with the new water supply. Water is an essential need for all human beings. So again, there were so many bad things that happened on the way. The crime was not the switch. The crime was the cover-up and the lack of due diligence and doing the work. And then when they saw that there was a problem, instead of being forthcoming, saying, we made a mistake, we've got to turn back, or investing the money for anti-corrosion control, investing the money to meet all of the standards, investing the money to do the ongoing testing, not of what's in the infrastructure, but of what's coming out of people's faucets. Because what's coming out of people's faucets is what they're consuming. So if you're testing water somewhere in the water infrastructure, you're going to get whatever you get. But what people are actually exposed to is what's coming out of their tap. And there was so much cover-up that happened, and so many people along the way. Martin Luther King said, in order for bad things to persist, good people have to do nothing. A lot of so-called good people not only did nothing, but actively covered up.
Stay right there. Hold on. Stay right there. I need you all to stay with me for a couple more minutes because we got to wrap this up. And I need the mayor
to give us.
Because I want you to have the last word on this because this is a mess. And, you know, everyone calls people who see these plans and who make these linkages, they call you a conspiracy theorist. That's not true. The thing is, you see relationships. You see relationships. And this literally is corporate malfeasance. It's government malfeasance. People were violated. People are dying. And somebody needs to be held to account for that. Not just government officials, but the corporatocracy, the corporate officials who made this happen. We'll be talking about this and the impeachment and everything else on the Santita Jackson Show. Back in just a minute.
This is the Santita Jackson Show.
Oh, if you were only on Facebook Live on the Santita Jackson Show. Santita Jackson and friends, I'm Santita Jackson coming to you on Wednesday, January 13th, 2021. On the Santita Jackson Show, on the largest progressive talk radio station in the nation, WCPT 820 and AM 950 radio. My brothers and sisters to the north, Minneapolis, St. Paul, the voice of progressive Minnesota. I am Santita Jackson. It's a joy to be with you today. Everybody like and share on the Santita Jackson and Friends page. And we are streaming on WCPT 820's page as well. If you want to listen to us online. If you can't watch us on Facebook, go to WCPT820.com or AM950radio.com. Call or text us at 773-763-WCPT, 773-763-9278. GWC Injury Lawyers gives you that opportunity, and we want to hear from you. And I'm trying to get Wanda, Miss Wanda, up and out in North Carolina. Love you and love Mr. Corey and Meddy. That's right. And Dave Dowling, our brother to the north, up in Canada. And let's see, Nina Gagenheimer, my sweet, and Paula and Priscilla and Shirley from Philadelphia and Carol out there in Beverly Hills and Michael Ann and on and on and on and on. Tanya. We are talking about a whole lot. I guess we've just got a smash up today because we have the honor of having the former mayor of Flint, Michigan, Dr. Karen Weaver. Karen about Flint, if you want to follow her on social media. And we've got attorney C.K. Hoffler, the president of the National Bar Association, the largest and oldest black bar association in the world. And she's also the chair of Rainbow Push. And we've got Dr. Deborah Furholden, one of the world's leading epidemiologists, the associate dean of public health at Michigan State University. Indeed, she moved to Flint to help work on that crisis. And, of course, joining us, Reverend Dr. Todd Yeary, Esquire, senior pastor of the Douglas Memorial Community Church in Baltimore, Maryland. But he's also the senior vice president of Rainbow Push, a brilliant theologian, pastor. Now he also helps to do the good news on the Santita Jackson Show. He's a lawyer. He just does it all. Attorney Robert Patillo, Southeastern Regional Director of Rainbow Push. I guess we have Rainbow Push on the brain here today. Of course, he is also a brilliant civil rights lawyer, and he hosts his own radio show on WAOK, the iconic Black Talk radio station in Atlanta, every Sunday from 12 to 3 Central Standard Time, 1 to 4 Eastern Standard Time. And for Carol and Michael and all of you a little bit farther west, that's 10 to 1 p.m. on the West Coast, and Mountain, that would be 11 to 2. All right, so we got that out the way, everybody. We are going to have a high of 41 degrees today in Chicago. It will be cloudy. Minneapolis, St. Paul, a high of 38 degrees. Snow showers. The Dow was up yesterday 60 points. The NASDAQ closed up 36 points. The S&P 500 closed up a point and a half. Let's go to some of these headlines, Paul. The GOP support for President Trump is cracking. Everybody, according to this headline from the Huffington Post, GOP support for impeachment is growing as Republicans say that they will vote against President Trump. According to this report, the GOP dam broke on Tuesday when Representative John Katko of New York said he'd vote to impeach the president. But things really got interesting when the number three Republican in the House, Representative Liz Cheney of Wyoming, issued a stark statement saying that she, too, would vote to impeach because of Trump's direct role in inciting the riot. She said on Tuesday, a violent mob attacked the U.S. Capitol to obstruct the process of our democracy and to stop the counting of presidential electoral votes. The president of the United States summoned this mob, assembled the mob, and lit the flame of this attack. Everything that followed was his doing. None of this would have happened without the president. Whew. And indeed, as the House readies bipartisan impeachment articles of impeachment for Trump, they are saying that he is a clear and present danger to the Republican. He must be removed now. What do you think about that? Call or text me, 773-763-WCPT, 773-763-9278. In the meantime, we have now three members of Congress who have tested positive for COVID-19 after sheltering together during the Capitol insurrection. As you might remember, over 100 members of Congress sheltered together in a secure location for hours. But many Republican congresspersons refused to put on masks. And now Representative Bonnie Watson Coleman of New Jersey, a 75-year-old cancer survivor, COVID-19 positive. Representative Pramila Jayapal of Washington, COVID-19 positive. And Brad Schneider of Illinois, COVID-19 positive. And we are awaiting more and more COVID-19 positive congresspersons and perhaps staff members. Ayanna Pressley, the congresswoman out of Massachusetts, saw that these congresspersons refused to mask, and she left the room. Now, mind you, this is while all the chaos was going on in the Capitol. She risked her life. She said, I am not going to stay in this room with these people. Blessings to her. In the meantime, we're watching President Trump's approval rating crater in his final days in office, and yet people are trying to get him removed. A new Politico Morning Consult poll pegs President Trump's approval rating at just 30%. 4%. Mitch McConnell is said to believe that impeachment would make it easier to purge Trump from the GOP. And now, indeed, he is supporting impeachment. What will that mean, everybody? Will he be impeached in the Senate? What do you think? In the meantime, Vice President Pence is still refusing to invoke the 25th Amendment as Democrats and now Republicans are working to remove President Trump. The FBI is warning. Well, they had a report last week that warned the Capitol of war. That's how they put it. Contradicting claims that there was no indication of looming violence. What did they know? When did they know it? Who knew what, everybody? Now comes word from the FBI that President Trump supporters are planning armed protests ahead of the Biden inauguration. Keep a lookout, everybody. They're also warning of nationwide plans. Armed protests next week. Do you think that's going to happen? Oh, my goodness. I hope not. After her COVID-19 test came back positive, Congresswoman Jayapal has demanded of the House Sergeant-at-Arms that GOP lawmakers be removed who refuse masks. Should they also be fined, everybody? You let me know. In the aftermath of what happened a week ago today, the siege at the Capitol, the House has installed metal detectors to check congressional lawmakers. Not visitors, but the lawmakers after the Capitol riots. And many Republicans have objected to being checked, but they said, you know, we cannot trust who is coming in to vote now. This is unbelievable. And what's also unbelievable is that there's an extraordinary letter that was issued yesterday by the U.S. military. The nation's top commanders condemned last week's acts of sedition and insurrection. And in fact, they said that the U.S. military will obey lawful orders from civilian leadership, support civilian authorities to protect lives and property, ensure public safety in accordance with the law, and remain lawfully committed, fully committed, to protecting and defending the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. It's amazing that they felt the need, that these Pentagon chiefs felt the need to issue that kind of statement, as more and more people are asking how many military people were involved in this attack. Sadly, yesterday, we saw a record-breaking number of COVID-19 deaths, nearly 4,500 people, according to Johns Hopkins, died yesterday from COVID-19. And in L.A., they're even going so far as asking people to wear their masks at home. We've got a lot going on. We've been talking with former Mayor Karen Weaver of Flint, Michigan, Dr. Karen Weaver, noted psychologist, and Dr. Deborah Furholden, Associate Dean of Public Health at Michigan State University, and Attorney C.K. Hoffler of the National Bar Association and Chair of Rainbow Push. And, of course, we're joined by Robert Petillo, Attorney Robert Petillo, Southeastern Regional Director of Rainbow Push, and, of course, civil rights lawyer and Reverend Dr. Todd Leary, President, Vice President of Rainbow Push, and Senior Pastor of the Douglas Memorial Community Church. Of course, they are correctly, ladies, standing back, they said, as we take the floor and talk about what's happening in Flint, Michigan. And I know as we talk about Flint, Michigan, as we talk about the impeachment, there's so much on the table today. It's like you don't have enough time to cover it all, but we tried to do that because even the Flint, Michigan story is not getting the shine, Mayor Weaver, that it should be getting. I mean, I think, you know, after the cameras left Flint, you know, we just said, okay, but the problem never left.
The problem never left. You're absolutely right. And let me just say, because I know I have to sign off, but I need to thank you, and I need to thank C.K. Hoffler and Dr. Deborah Furholden, because they not only have my back, but they have Flint's back. And that's what we need, are people that aren't scared, that will speak up and speak out about this injustice that's going on. And while, you know, we talk about what's happening in Flint with the water, and we know that, cities and municipalities all around this country have issues around water quality standards and infrastructure. One of the things I've always told people was to pay attention to Flint, because it wasn't about water and it wasn't about infrastructure. Those were the symptoms of systemic racism, and that's what took place in Flint. That's why this has gone on for so long. It's because of race and it's because of class. And like we were talking earlier, this would not have happened if we were in St. Clair Shore, Michigan, It would not have happened. If it had, it would have been fixed. We would not have had to fight for every single thing we have gotten. I hope they go to prison. I said, somebody said, what do you think should happen? I said, well, I don't know. Usually when you kill people, you go to prison. You don't get to just sit at home. Hmm. I said, and people died in the city of Flint, and there have been so many deaths that are unaccounted for because, you know, like we said, we were told the water was good. So we know about Legionnaires, but people aren't talking about those pneumonia deaths. You know, they're not talking about the stillbirths and the miscarriages. They're not talking about kids that will never reach their full potential because they've been damaged. They're not talking about people that have lost limbs in the city of Flint and the mental and emotional damage that this community has had to suffer with. And so we're saying that this happened because of race and class, and this settlement, the amount and the distribution is the same thing. And so I'm so glad we were having this conversation because we weren't worth $100 a day for corrosion control. We were not worth that. And somebody asked me, what would I say to Governor Snyder? I said, I'd say to him what he said to me when I came down to Lansing to fight for the people, and he told me to get over it. I said, that's what get over it.
No, stop. You were going real fast. I want people to hear.
I get heated. What?
No. Yeah. I want people to hear. What Governor, make us be there. Make us
what
be
Governor
there.
What Governor Snyder said to me?
Yes.
Yes, because I went to meet with him, and I had taken a lot of my executive team with me because he was shutting down our water pods. And I thought, you know, I'm trying to work with you here. And I went to meet with him, and we were halfway through the the lead service line replacement. So I was willing to compromise. I went there with that on my mind to say, okay, we had 8 or 9 water distribution centers open. You know, we're over halfway through, shut down half of them, but still continue to give people access to, you know, bottled water until we get through this. If you don't shut down half of them, instead of giving 8 cases out, give 4 cases out. We can make this work. I just brought, you know, some new staff because I thought this is going to be fine and we're going to talk about other things. And as I said that, he told me I should never have challenged him when I wrote an open letter and that Flint needs to get over it. And I remember I turned to one of the people that I had brought with me, and I said, what did he just say to me? And he said, get over it. I said, oh, this meeting is over. This meeting is over. I shut my book. I said, let's go. You know, the fight is on again. The fight is on again. And that was what he said. He had the audacity, the nerve to say we needed to get over it. And so now, you know, those words have come back to bite him. I sincerely hope and pray. So he can go somewhere and sit down in prison and get over it.
Well, do you know what? I want everyone on the panel. I know we were going to be talking about impeachment. We can get to that. But I want everyone. We're not going to even exclude the guys. I want everybody to react to Governor Snyder telling the mayor of Flint to get over it. First, you, Dr. Deborah Froholden, get over it.
Well, there's a thing called poetic justice, and I don't actually want him to get over it. I want him to actually really own and stand in the impact, and clearly he has no incentive to do that on his own, and I'm just happy to see that it looks like we're actually going to have an opportunity for people to have justice. When you ask people in Flint, what do you want? Yeah, they want a fair settlement. They want all of that. What they really want is justice. A part of people being restored to whole is they want a legitimate acknowledgement of what was done to them. And they want the people who did it, who turned a blind eye, who didn't do their job, who lied to them, to be held to account. And to hear that this is what our mayor, who was our champion and fighting for us. I remember when they shut those water stations down. Mind you, I'm in a position I can afford to go buy, you know, 10 cases of bottled water every week to meet my family's needs. So many of our residents weren't. And to hear that Mayor Weaver, who's fighting a good fight, had to deal with and contend with those conversations. We want justice. We want justice. And Mayor Weaver, my heart goes out to you. Yes. I respect you as a leader. I know you fought the good fight for us, and you're still fighting a good fight for us, which is what makes you a real class act, because you're not doing it because of the title. You're not doing it because of the elected position. You're doing it because it's who you are for us. And we love you and appreciate you for it. And I just want to go on the record and say, Mayor Weaver lost that election by about 100 votes. That was a whole nother little coup where we got a lot of Republican votes thrown the other way, and we're splitting hairs. But let's not be mistaken. Mayor Weaver was our biggest champion. So I salute you. I appreciate you. And I'm sorry that you had that, but you know Flint still loves you.
Well, you know what? I didn't want her to lose, but she didn't lose. She won. I'm glad that it happened so the people of Flint could see the powers that don't want you to have a voice. Before I get to you, C.K. Hoffa, let me go to you, Robert Petillo. What do you make of this? Get over it. Get over it. Lead in your water.
It's something that... It's something which is only told, as you said, to poor communities, to African-American communities, to minority communities. This concept that somehow we are not worthy of the equal rights, equal protections under law that every other American citizen is. And I think it's a Cassiopeia for us to reassert our political power, that it's the people who are in charge, not corporations, not developers, not even the politicians. They are a caretaker over the republic, not the a ruling oligarch or bureaucracy. And the fact that it took this long for people to be brought to justice and the damage is still done shows the need for severe and systemic political reform, not just in Michigan, but across the country. Because for every Flint that actually got attention, there's, you know, fracking in West Virginia where sinks are catching on fire. There's economic issues around the country and environmental racism people have to take control of and look at for poor people, because many of the public health issues that we have can be directly attributed towards economic and systemic issues of environmental racism and environmental issues that are particularly dumped upon poor communities. So we need to take this as a model and expand around the country to other areas that are exhibiting very similar events and very similar populations that are being hurt by it.
Reverend Dr. Urie, because I want CK to tell us how we can sue. Reverend Dr. Urie, this is just unbelievable. Get over it. How do you react to that? Just okay, Reverend.
There are two ways that I actually react to it. One is it kind of takes the wind out of you, but then it's a reminder of the adage that goes, the more things change, the more they remain the same. It is not the first time that we've seen power structure interests disrespect the needs of the most vulnerable through their leaders and their representatives. There's also the race-gender dynamic in this conversation that we don't have enough time to even go into, where a black woman with credentials and authority comes in on behalf of her constituents writ large and has to be subjected to the demeaning, dehumanizing verbiage and personal disrespect of a white man. That's a whole different discussion. So as the son of a black mama, I have a whole lot going through me right now, and one of them is kind of directed rage. It's one of the reasons why we see what we see going on at the Capitol, is that we have this continuum of dehumanization and disrespect that continues to advance the interest of the entitlement class and relegates everybody else to a certain level of acceptable suffering. And then tells us when we come to even negotiate a position of moderation, when really the demand should be, don't touch nothing, right? Let me figure out how I can work with you so that we can still move this forward. And what you get back is get over it. So we have to kind of put it in a historical continuum, because black folk, poor white folk. We've been hearing "get over it" since the founding of the Republic. That's why the founding document is framed the way that it is, because we the people leaves out a key word. We all the people. People is a certain status that is not afforded to everybody. Hence, we see, as you all have discussed off air and on Facebook Live while we were observing the sisters do what they do, because brothers know we ain't getting in that because they got this. We know where we've seen this before. And so what I would simply say, my reaction is, you expect nothing from a pig but a grunt. That's all I got.
Ouch. Well, Anthewine wants you to put on the put your Vaseline on and get down. So there we go.
pop
on my. I mean, you know, there was so much. That's why I had to have you repeat that, Mayor Weaver, Dr. Weaver.
Yeah.
That, because I said, wait, you're sitting in a meeting with the sitting governor as the sitting mayor of a major American city. And he looks at you as people are dying, as children are being developmentally disabled, and women are losing their children. They're miscarrying. And he looks at you and says, get over it.
Yes.
Wow.
So I hope he has a long time to sit and think on those words. I really, really do. I really do.
More thoughts.
It was so nice to be able to use his words on him. Karma is a what?
I got 30 seconds, literally.
Okay. All I wanted to say to Mayor Weaver, when you testify, because you're going to testify, you're going to need counsel. I volunteer to be your lawyer. You can have other lawyers, whatever, too, but I volunteer to be right there by your side. Oh, yeah.
We're going to be in the courtroom with her.
Yes.
Back in just a minute. Yes.
This is the Santita Jackson Show.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Santita Jackson Show. Now, we've had a good time this morning talking about some really tough topics. This is what I love about being on the Santita Jackson Show on WCPT 820, the nation's largest progressive talk radio station, and AM 950 Radio, the voice of progressive Minnesota, and Facebook Live, the Santita Jackson and Friends page. Join the Morning Stars over there. We've been talking about what's happened in Flint. It's still a crisis there, but today we have something historic that's going to happen. It's going to start in about 30 minutes. President Donald Trump will be the first American president, the first in the history of the Republic to get to be impeached twice. Talk to me, Reverend Dr. Yeary.
Well, it's as we would say, it is what it is. Let me tell you where I would start with it. Congressman Jamie Raskin, who goes way back with Reverend Raskin. I remember him when he was in the state Senate before he ran for Congress. He's a constitutional law professor and just a student of constitutional history. He laid out yesterday so well and in such an elementary, not in a demeaning way, but just in a basic way, what the issues are, that I think it helps folks to understand why the procedure or the process is really so critical. What we also saw on yesterday was a letter that was sent from the vice president to Speaker Pelosi, also explaining why he was not going to invoke the 25th Amendment, and it had something to do with there's no medical incapacity that is at play here. So there's really no appropriate application of the 25th Amendment. And what we have is, what do you do in this moment, right? Everybody says, well, he only has less than a week left now, or coming up on a week left now in office. Why not just let it go away? Because here's why. If you give a tacit endorsement, and let's not forget what is stoking at the root of a lot of this, based on what we've heard, the coordination that we've seen, the infiltration that we know has taken place in police departments and state law enforcement offices and in the U.S. military, that there's been an infiltration of the ideology of the efforts to start a race war. Let me go back and give you the continuum. That was exactly the mindset that Dylann Roof had when he walked into Mother Emanuel AME Church. The slaughter there was an effort to stoke a race war. What we have seen is not microaggression, but macroaggression, trying to go back to the fundamental issue of difference and distinction that still doesn't deal with the fundamental issue that the folks who are in power, really in power, if you do a power analysis, it is a combination of wealth. Rick Snyder, his balance sheet is over $200 million. He wasn't just the governor. He was a rich governor, talking about the conditions of poor working people. So when we look at what's going on, folks have gotten trapped in what we've seen. And at the head of this is a multimillionaire. We can argue about what the president's net worth may or may not be. But there are some interests that are driving this, and they're not the obvious ones that we think. And in the effort to at least protect some sense of integrity and credibility in the system, I think it is necessary that there be a fundamental civics lesson about how you maintain some level of accountability. Otherwise, you have no accountability, and I promise you, havoc is going to break out. If there's nothing to at least raise the awareness of the people along the way, whether or not you can get to him in enough time, whether you can follow the process through, whether or not Mitch McConnell's going to try to put on a trial, all of that is actually secondary. What's going to be the initial response? And it cannot be the national version of what we just heard that former Governor Rick Snyder said to Mayor Karen Weaver. It cannot be that the country just needs to get over.
Robert Petillo, what say you?
We're seeing the fundamental weakness of the American system and the American democracy, that one of the things that was in Washington's farewell address was the concept of factionalism and his fear that it would overthrow and destroy the republic, much as you saw in Central Europe during that the same period of time. We've now fallen into that version of factionalism, where it's no longer about having political disagreements. If you talk to many of the MAGA supporters, they sound like Bernie Sanders supporters. They're on Social Security and Medicare. They believe they get VA checks. They believe that the government does not look out for the working man and woman. So it's not an ideological split. It's a cultural divide. It's a factional divide, which are far harder to heal together. And the fact that our governmental system is not equipped to deal with that, it's not equipped to deal with a demagogue of this nature, it shows that we're going to have to make certain systemic changes, starting with the impeachment today. I was talking about this issue on Indian TV yesterday in Mumbai, and they had very clear questions of, well, why is it easier for Facebook and Twitter to regulate the president than Congress? And we don't have a good answer for that. That tech companies can censor the president, but we have such a recalcitrant political system that it's nearly impossible, even when a president launches a riot that kills five people in the United States Capitol, to even get Republicans then to call up their charade of challenging the Electoral College results. When you're dealing with this lack of institutionalism, where party is more important than principle, party is more important than country, winning at all cost is really the only efforts that they care about, well, then you have to look into structural changes. And I think we're going to have to legislatively in the administration find out how exactly a Congress can reel back in a rogue president of this nature. They can't work in a bipartisan fashion, or when there's a split house where one party has control and the other doesn't. Because right now we see that with impeachment being the only tool, and Trump learned from the first impeachment that once they don't have 70 votes in the Senate, then it doesn't really matter. So I can still do whatever the hell I want. And he's right. And so we have to put some institutional safeguards. It's going to have to be federal legislation. There might need to be a constitutional amendment, frankly, and I think the American people don't see that at this point. It's going to be very difficult to ever bring the nation back together, but we have to find ways to reel a rogue president back in, because we've already ceded the power of the purse string from Congress to the executive branch. That's how he was able to start his border wall. We've ceded the power to make and declare war away from the Congress and to the executive branch into the Department of Defense, so he can launch 100 Tomahawk cruise missiles at another nation with no congressional approval. So we're going to have to remove many of these powers from the presidency and get back to the balance and checks and balances that were originally intended in the constitutional system that we have.
Do you see him being removed from office, Robert?
I don't think he's going to be removed from office. Because our system is so broken, as long as you have a political majority in one house of Congress, literally the president is untouchable. That if he doesn't care about being impeached, if he just calls it a hoax and a fake, there's really no way to control them. And so I don't see Republicans coming along and agreeing that a president launching a terrorist attack on the Capitol is enough to remove him from office, because they're more worried about winning the next election cycle than they are about sustaining our Democratic Republic.
Attorney C.K. Hoffler, you said you want to see people, you want to see prosecutions, not persecutions, prosecutions, because of the bedlam that we saw. I mean, just, and now we're beginning to hear, you saw something unprecedented. You saw the Pentagon chiefs who said, wait a minute, we obey civilian law, but we're finding out a lot of people who were in the crowd were military. Yeah. When the Capitol Police asked for military support, they couldn't get it. They call the Pentagon. Yeah. I said, wait. Now people, we have the head of the Chicago Police, the fire, which is the FOP, the Fraternal Order of Police, a police union. He supported the rioters. He's come back. He's backed off of it because now aldermen in Chicago are saying, you know, you need to be put out of your job. I said, well, wait a minute. He's really reflecting how the police deal with us anyway. CK, what are we looking at? Should we just walk away from this?
Absolutely not. We cannot walk away from this. To walk away from this would be, I will tell you literally, Dr. King and all of those who've gone on to glory will be turning in their graves. We cannot walk away from this. We must hold people accountable, and we must prosecute to the fullest. I slightly disagree with my colleague, Robert Petillo. I think we can still get the president out of office, because even though there is in the Senate a majority, many of those senators, I believe, are going to endorse, are going to support an impeachment. And so I think we need to, and I know the impeachment process is a long process. The best thing would have been for Vice President Pence to take a different position. I think people, Republicans, they have said, and we understand, fear for their lives, the lives of their family, because of the ramifications of them taking an adverse position to the president, because of all the riots that are being planned, because of all the intimidation, because of all of the threats. So I do think it's not over yet. I think it's possible, and we need to fight every single day to get him out of office, because every single day that he's in office, every single day, not just this country, but the world is in peril. That's number one. Number two, we need to hold those at the Defense Department and in the military who are complicit, whether they look the other way, whether they fail to return a call, whether they put in blocks for whatever reason to law enforcement getting to the Capitol to protect members of Congress and those innocent people. We need to hold them accountable too. No one should get a pass. Not a single person should get a pass who was in the chain of this conspiracy. And I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but this was a conspiracy, well planned, well organized, well orchestrated. Everybody in that chain must be held accountable. They must be held accountable. These were acts of terrorism. Did we say when the terrorists came in and killed innocent people, destroyed the Twin Towers and 9/11, did we say, well, maybe we should think of holding them accountable? No. We said they must be held accountable. We're going to do everything in our power. And that's the same level of passion, enthusiasm, and need for justice that we have to employ here. Not a scintilla left.
You've got to find out why, everybody. Dr. Deborah for Holden, are you still there? You've got to find out why.
I'm here.
Okay,
I'm here.
Okay.
And I fall right in the middle. I believe in CK's position and the need, but I ultimately agree with Robert's bottom line. They're not going to impeach that man, and I think we should, but I don't want to shoulda all over this conversation, because it's not going to happen. And I believe a lot of these so-called, you know, people who now want to stand for democracy and all that are doing that because their horse lost the race. And it's now become in vogue to pretend that you care about all this stuff. People care about power and holding power. And since he no longer will seemingly serve their long-range mm-hmm. purposes, they've switched horses. And now they're, and their new horse is right. democracy and fairness.
Let me say this to everyone. Okay.
I don't believe what they're saying. I don't believe what they're saying because you don't switch overnight. But let's get them out. I don't care how we get them out. Let's use those people who are being duplicitous and who are now switching gears because they lost to get him out.
But this is what I am saying, and I want us to ponder this. I think that while we are looking at President Trump, and we should, we're not. He did not personally, I don't think, call these U.S. Capitol Police who didn't show up. We had Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst, who briefed every president of the United States in the 80s. He is that trusted and was that highly ranked in the CIA. 2,300 police, U.S. Capitol Police, are on the Capitol every day. 500, according to the information that he got, the intel that he got, were there. How is it that 1,800 police don't show up for work, and you all don't call the congresspersons and staff don't show up, and you don't call members of Congress and say, something is not right, don't come into Congress today? Something is off. People knew how to get around the hill. No one knows how to get around the hill. You can be there for a long time. It's all these tunnels and whatnot. It's a hard place to navigate, to negotiate. And now it's beginning to come out. We're seeing different police officers from all over the country. Even members of the FDNY, the Fire Department of New York City, were there. And on and on and on and on and on. I don't want us, I think we have to look at the president, but we have to look at, it's to me, it's even bigger than he is. Because a whole lot of people were in this. These people knew to go to the office of the parliamentarian. That is where all of the legislative business is done. How did they know to go there?
Well, now there's information.
Starting with you, Robert. Okay, Robert, then. Okay.
Yeah, there's actually a report on CNN this morning saying that at least three members of Congress were in communication with many of the leaders of the riot and helping them to organize it. This was a well-planned out, well-thought-out, with complicit members of Congress. Alex Jones even said that he was in constant communication with the White House during the riot, telling him where to be at, where to lead people, what doors to enter in. So I think as we have congressional hearings in the next administration, we're going to have to root out these seditionists, members of Congress, and ultimately expel them from the U.S. Congress.
Because, look, the Pentagon chiefs of staff came out and said something they've never had to do before. We obey civilian authority. Really? Something didn't happen there, Todd, and you're a veteran. Not putting you on point for all the military, but, you know.
So if you understand the military, the commander-in-chief is a civilian. That's the president. The militia, better known as the National Guards, are controlled by the executives of the states. D.C. not being a state, the mayor has no authority to activate nor mobilize the D.C. National Guard. That actually rests with the Department of Defense through the appointed authority that comes from the president. That's number one. Number two, we have to remember that the power of the presidency, we've talked about pardons. What we haven't talked about is that the president has singular sign-off authority to grant any level of security clearance to whomever he chooses just by saying that's what he wants. So the ability to know and what one can know has a lot to do with who's in the seat. Now, here's why there's a push. And I think we're seeing the pushback from some in the Republican Party. The Republican Party is no longer a party. It's the party of Donald Trump. They're trying to reclaim an identity, and they're seizing an opportunity where they know if they don't stain him where he's disqualified from coming back, he's coming back. And so what you're seeing is Dr. Frankenstein trying to come get his monster. And if it doesn't happen using the implements of the legislative branch and the incentives that are coming mostly from the Democratic Party, the Republican Party knows that Frankenstein, the monster, is going to come back and get the doctor. And so that's what's playing out. And so you have infiltration that has happened intentionally and deliberately over a period of time. You have folks who are in positions of what they can and do know. What we don't know is what they've shared in terms of internal dynamics. And at the same time, you have similar infiltration. And I know this to be the case where the recruitment in police departments that have been understaffed, when they've talked about the loss of officers, some of those positions have been filled by folks who are not necessarily of the same mindset of protect and serve as we would otherwise think. So let's not get this twisted. When Madam Chair talks about this being a conspiracy, it is a conspiracy at some of the deepest levels, including people in elected office and appointed office who aren't just complicit. Complicit is, you know, you just kind of let it slide. No, they are co-conspirators in the advancement of a conspiracy. And there should be a whole lot of very prominent names that will come to the forefront, having been charged by sedition and insurrection under 18 U.S.C.
Well, what is a sedition and insurrection?
So it's inciting basically the overthrow of the government it's a very broadly written federal statute. So there isn't a lot of specific behavior. There are a lot of generalities, which I think pulls the president's words and conduct into a higher level of scrutiny. But it also puts those who were there, right? They may have not been there with the intent to participate in it. But once you're in it, if you don't pull yourself out from it intentionally, you get caught up just like the deepest offenders who are doing the most damage. And so I think what we're saying is while they're saying there have been 100 or so people charged, there are going to be hundreds of people ultimately charged if they can just do enough examining a face recognition software from all of the number of cameras that are on the complex, and they'll begin to identify who these folks are. But really, the biggest inciter by virtue of language and conduct and specious behavior, raising the issues of the election was stolen when the courts have said it wasn't stolen, when secretaries of state said that was not the case. That is knowing behavior used to incite a group of people to act in a coordinated way against the interests of the government, which in and of itself is sedition.
Well, you know what? I think about the movie JFK. Thank you, Oliver Stone, for all of his brilliance. And, excuse me, I think about how I've, you know, even grown politically since having seen that movie. Well, that was out in 1991, I believe it was, so long ago. And, you know, many people said, you know, President Kennedy was killed because he was fighting for civil rights. Well, there's a book entitled The Bystander that lets you know that he was very ambivalent, deeply ambivalent about civil rights. And it was LBJ who carried what some people felt were his ambitions through. There's a character in who's very highly ranked in that movie who goes after Jim Garrison, the DA out of New Orleans, who really tried to pursue the killer of the president. And this man met him, you know, of course they took, you know, license, and they said, you know, he met at the mall, and he said, look, let me tell you what you need to do. They're not going to kill you because you've got too much light on you. But you're the only one who's asking the right questions. And he said, what you need to find out is who benefited from his death. Not just the shooter. That's important. He said, but what's more important is who benefited. Not just who, but the industries that benefited. Because remember, you had a whole... President Trump got billions of dollars worth of free media. And when he went in, he took CEOs with him, not middle management, not the co-chair. He took the heads of the major corporations with him. This is bigger than he is. He's going to be out no matter what happens in another week. Who pulled the police from Capitol Hill? Who directed these people? This was almost like a military operation. These people knew where to go. They knew where to go on the Hill. They knew to go to the parliamentarian's office. Who does that? People don't even know what the parliamentarian is. They don't even know that it exists. So while I think we need to look at the president, absolutely. You need to look at these other people who are going to be there after he's gone. I think. Now, I got about 2 minutes. I'm going to give everybody 30 seconds because, you know, no matter what, they're going to cut us off. So very quickly, Deborah Verholden, you got about 20 seconds.
I agree with you is the short answer. And the fact that so many people have so much to benefit is why they're not going to impeach him. But surely a lot of pomp and circumstance and posturing and gesturing will make it look like for the masses that they're out in front doing something, but nothing's going to really happen. That doesn't mean we shouldn't fight for it, but I would find it very hard to believe that all of those power dynamics magically get undone, that all the favors that got accrued magically now go away just because he didn't win the re-election. And I wouldn't be surprised if he survives if we don't have to deal with him again in 2024. So that's my two cents.
You know, Daniel, I'm going to come to you. Let me go very quickly. Daniel is calling from Manchester, New Hampshire. Daniel, what's on your mind, sweetie?
You guys.
Daniel?
I'm relatively, can you hear me?
Oh, yeah, now I can. Yes. Yes, yes. I got 1 minute before we get off there. We're giving it to you.
Yes, ma'am. I'm new to your show, and my question for you is, why doesn't the top brass, the DNC, speak like you do? I believe if the entire DNC spoke with your kind of conviction, the people like me that are typically far left would have no problem backing the DNC. But I think the DNC plays too much kumbaya while y'all are saying, and I think the most profound thing somebody said was... True justice is a realization of what actually happened, you know, and not sweeping it under the rug, but going after it. And I'm afraid the DNC won't do that. I want to know what y'all think about that. Thank you.
Well, you know what? Let me say this as we go out. And stay right there, Daniel, because we're going to be on Facebook Live for a couple of minutes after we go. Everybody's got to go to work today. You know what? I've been an independent Democrat, and that's where I am. And I think that those who decide to remain in the Democratic Party need to continue to push the party, as Bernie Sanders, who is an independent, continues to do. That's what we need to do. I don't speak from DNC talking points. Anyone who knows me knows that I do not do that. I speak from my heart, and I speak from my experiences. And I try to speak for you, and I try to give you the platform so that you can speak for yourselves. That's why you hear the kind of straight talk here that you hear. So I want you to know that what we have to continue to do is fight. Never, ever, 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 ever surrender. Fight for the people. Fight for the ancestors. Fight to make this country what it's supposed to be, where everyone can live and breathe freely. Continue to fight. Do not stop. Can't stop, don't stop, won't stop. This is our country. Let's make it work for all of us. Stay right there. I love you, everybody.